Okay, today is, what is today? October 29th. This is the first interview with Ken Shapiro. We're here on the fourth floor of Steenbach Library inside the UW-Madison Archives. And my name is Troy Reeves, and I head the oral history program for the UW-Madison Archives. Ken, thanks for coming here this morning. First thing, as I mentioned before I turn the recorder on, if you could for make sure we get the recording purposes, recording levels correct, if you could say your name and then spell your last name.
My name is Kenneth Shapiro, S-H-A-P-I-R-O.
All right. That will be that voice quality right there will be perfect.
Good.
So I mentioned in the emails, and I think also when we met, that this first session is going to be context, you know, your life, the highlights of your life, I guess, before you came here.
Okay.
So if you wouldn't mind starting off a little bit about your childhood and early years, where you grew up, where you're born, raised, things like that.
Okay, I was born in Brooklyn, borough of New York City, April 21st, 1942. And we moved from there. I was the only child. And we moved from there when I was about five to Long Beach, New York, part of the south shore of Long Island. And stayed there until another couple of years, and then moved to another place on Long Island called South Hempstead. And we shared a house with my aunt and uncle. And then when I was in third grade, moved back to Long Beach. And both times in Long Beach, we rented a small apartment in the upstairs of private residences. And I lived in Long Beach until I was off to college.
Okay. What were your parents' occupations?
Both parents worked. They were in retail sales. My father was a shoe salesman in the small shoe stores. He had his own store for a few years, but was undercapitalized, and that didn't last very long. My mother worked in large department stores. Abraham and Strauss was the one she worked in for the most time when we lived on Long Island.
Did you, growing up, was it public school?
Yeah, I went to public schools. My parents were what you might call of modest means. Some people might say they were poor. My mother didn't finish high school. She had to go to work to help support the family. And my father did finish high school, but obviously neither of them went on to college.
Okay. You said you lived for a while with an aunt and uncle?
Right. So it was my mother's sister and brother-in-law and their three kids, and my parents and I in a two-bedroom house, close quarters, but they all managed quite well.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was perfectly fine.
So were there other members of the extended family that you got to know or might have been influential as you were growing up?
Not influential, but the family on my mother's side was close. She had another sister and a brother, and the one brother lived in the town of Long Beach, so we got to know that family quite well. Sister was in Manhattan. My father's sister was in Manhattan also, and another sister he had was in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
But I wouldn't say they were influential, except for the sister and brother, my mother's sister and brother-in-law, whom we lived with for about 3 years and mm-hmm. stayed close with.
Have you stayed close with those cousins that you,
not
that you shared
really,
a house with?
Not really. We sort of attend weddings and such, but
okay.
haven't stayed close with them.
Now, growing up, going to public school, so you have a mother who didn't finish high school. What sort of value was placed on getting a good education as you were growing up?
It was in the grand tradition of first, second generation Jews that education was of primary importance, and it was expected that all the children in my generation, so my parents were first generation born in this country. Their parents came over from that part of Poland that moved back and forth between Russia and Poland. And so that my parents were born in the U.S. and it was expected that their children would go on to college. So all of my cousins went to college. And it, well, as I say, there was that tradition that education takes primary value.
So as you were going through public school, were there specific classes or specific interests that you started to form?
I would say not rabid interests. The one subject that was of more interest to me was biology. This was in the days before AP classes, but they did have an advanced biology class in my high school, and I took that. And I guess history was also of interest because there was a very interesting teacher. Excuse me.
And was that a history teacher who taught both world and U.S. history, or was it specific to one specialization?
It was mostly U.S. history.
Okay.
Yeah.
So as you were starting to get close to college age, did you go about researching where you wanted to go? How did the process build for you to eventually matriculate somewhere?
Well, there were two things that made the choice obvious. First, that we didn't have money for me to go to a private college, and it would have been difficult even to go out of state. But it was clear that I was going to a state college, and in New York, the best state college you could go to was at Cornell. Cornell is part private and part public. The public parts are the College of Agriculture and Labor Relations. And since I had the interest in biology, then the College of Agriculture, it made sense. I was interested in genetics, and so going to Cornell Ag School was logical. I guess I applied also to Penn State and Rhode Island, was accepted there, but Cornell was clearly the first choice.
My New York geography is horrible. How far away is Cornell from?
At that time, it was about a five-hour drive on bad roads.
Okay.
I gather that the road network is improved. This was 59 when I entered Cornell.
Okay. Do you have memories or anecdotes about the first your transition, from Long Island to Cornell?
Yes, very, very dramatic recollections. At that time, to enroll in the College of Agriculture at Cornell, you were required to either grow up on a farm, or if you didn't, like me, then you had to have a certain number of weeks of work on a farm. And for me, that meant the summer before going to college, as well as two other summers to acquire enough weeks of farm work, so that when I graduated from high school, that first summer after my high school, I spent on a very small dairy farm someplace upstate New York. I've lost track of where. And so I spent the entire summer there. When I say small, he was milking 13 cows. And it was just me and a very elderly, in my eyes, gentleman who was actually a World War I veteran. And there was the two of us all summer milking cows and cutting hay. That was my first thought. And then to, you had one chance, sorry, at Cornell, there was sort of an entrance exam for farming skills. And if you passed that, then you could opt out of the remaining weeks of farm experience. And I didn't pass. You needed to do things like be able to back up a four-wheel trailer. If you've never done that when you're riding a tractor, it's a skill that takes time to acquire. Mm-hmm. You needed to identify eight different types of hay and things like this. All I knew how to do was hook up the milking machines and drive the mower and the baler to mow hay.
So, were there times that summer This is a summary between high school and college when you were working at the dairy farm where you were reconsidering your choice?
No.
Okay.
That's what you did. And it was a good experience for me. Got me in good shape. Got me used to getting up at an early hour in the dark to go find the cows.
Now, once you got to Cornell that first year, were you staying in the dorms? What was your housing location or situation like?
It was in the dormitories. At that time, the freshman dorms were down at the bottom of what they called Library Slope, and the rest of the college was up the hill. And so that also was good physical activity, walking up that long hill early in the morning. And in those days, you started with a pretty heavy load. I was thinking about this. My freshman year, I took calculus, zoology, botany, chemistry, English, a once-a-week orientation class, and a once-a-week ROTC class. I gather that's a lot more than just the normal load for students now. In your outline, you ask about financing.
Sure.
I think that's significant to put down the difference between then and now. I received a Regents scholarship. So New York had the state Regents exams in those days, and I guess they still do. And if you did very well, then you got a small cash grant. And I believe that mine was something like $400 each semester. And to give you an idea of college costs, when I would go to register and present the $400 check or voucher, they would take out all tuition and fees and give me back $150. Mm. So between that and working from the time I was a freshman in various kitchens, washing dishes, and then some help from my parents, I was able to go through college without it. We didn't have loans and such like that in those days, but costs were a lot lower. It was a lot easier for someone of modest means to go to the premier state college.
Did you feel academically, did you feel prepared to take such a heavy load your freshman year?
No, I didn't. And it was a struggle.
Was there assistance in terms of tutors or anything like that, or was it just something that you just tried to plow your way through?
Yeah, if there was, I wasn't aware of it.
Okay.
Just soldiered on. Didn't do well that first semester.
What about roommates or friends? What sort of relationships did you build that first year?
So my freshman year roommate was actually a friend from high school, Sam Cohen by name. And then after that, I joined the fraternity and had various roommates. Sam was one at one time, Steve Potter, Alan Chimikoff. The latter two are architects that I know.
Okay. So at what point did you, or did you have to declare a major your first year, or were you taking classes to try to figure out exactly what you wanted to major in?
You know, I don't recall what the requirements were for declaring a major, but by the time I was a sophomore, I realized that while I enjoyed reading about the biology and reading about the genetics and the theories and that experiments that showed one thing or the other, what I didn't enjoy and was not successful at was the lab work. And so while biology was fun in the classroom and in the readings, the payoff in the lab was not there mm-hmm. for me nor for the grades. Mm-hmm. And at about that time, I guess in my sophomore year, I took a course in agricultural economics by a young, at that time, professor, John Meller. I'm not sure if he was then an assistant professor or had just gotten tenure. And John had come recently back from another stint in India. And while this was a general course in agricultural economics, it was a lot about economic development, and it was, for me, an exciting course. John went on to become quite renowned. He founded the International Food Policy Research Institute. He was the first director, and that's still today the premier international organization doing agricultural economics and development economics work. So that turned me and gave me an alternate to the genetics that I still considered fun, but was clearly not going to be a life's work. And I guess at some point I declared as a major agricultural economics.
Okay. Now, well, first off, could you spell that last name, John Mailer? Is that
Miller? M-E-L-L-O-R.
Okay, M-E-L-L-O-R. So, did Miller become a mentor of yours?
I guess you would say that. I would see him more than anybody else, but it was not what I would call a close mentor relationship. It was not an intensive undergraduate experience, shall we say?
Okay. At what point, so you were at Cornell from fall of 59 through spring of 63?
Right.
Okay. Did you, as you got along towards the end, did you have to take internships or anything like that in ag econ?
No, I was spending my summers on the farm. And in fact, that last summer, I guess it was the summer after my junior year, I had been able to connect with the U.S. Department of Agriculture Economic Research Service, and they offered me a summer position for that junior year. So I went to the authorities at Cornell and said, wouldn't it make sense for me, an ag econ major, to spend that summer in D.C. doing agricultural economics research instead of on a farm? And they said, no. Young man, you'll go back on the farm.
So wow.
I spent another summer milking cows. In between, I spent the summer on a vegetable truck farm.
And all of these farms were in New York State?
Yeah. So okay. The two dairy farms were what we called upstate north of Manhattan. And the truck farm was actually on Long Island. Wrote fresh corn and other vegetables into the city every morning.
Okay. Were you able to stay at home when you worked at the truck farm?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'd be out there before anyone else was on the road and drive up to the north shore of Long Island where they had these farms and be there early in the morning when the dew was still on the fields, harvesting corn, getting soaking wet. Interesting experience.
Mm-hmm. So at what point, or was there a point during your undergraduate that you were either thinking about or deciding to do advanced degree work?
I guess it was probably in my senior year. And I still remember, or maybe have manufactured, the meeting with John Miller about that when I said that I'd like to do graduate work in agricultural economics. And I think that's when he laughed, because I had not been a very serious student. I used to do well in my economics courses, but I persisted in taking those biology classes because I enjoyed them, even though I didn't do well. So that, I don't know what my GPA was, but it was not stellar, that's for sure. And he said, well, he could recommend me to a colleague at University of Maryland. And he said, that's not the greatest place for you to do your graduate work. Now it's actually one of the top places to do graduate work in ag economics, but then its reputation was not so strong. And he said, so if you do well there, then you can go on to a better school. So.
Now, was part of your getting your degree, did you have to do any sort of senior seminar paper or a thesis or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
No.
So was Maryland the only place that you applied?
I don't remember. I
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's where you went.
It's likely that, it's likely that that was the only place I applied.
Okay. Did you take any time off between undergraduate and graduate?
No. But, excuse me, that summer, though, was an important experience for me between Cornell and Maryland. I got a job at one of the public housing projects in New York City where they ran a summer camp for kids who lived in the projects, i.e. kids from very poor families. So that was an important experience for me to get to know those kids, and some of the parents invited me to dinner in the projects, my projects, I mean the public housing. And these were in what was then called East Harlem or Spanish Harlem in New York.
Do you feel it's important because you were able to meet people who you wouldn't have any other way?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And to get a sense of what it means to be living in those circumstances and to know the kids. You know, the kids are bright as buttons and great kids, and to know what was in store for them, the odds against them. I was responsible for about 15 kids who were about, 8 years old.
And what sort of things would you do during the day with them?
Well, there were some activities on site. There was what they called a settlement house in the projects. And then we would take long walks over to Central Park and lark around there. There was an old castle in the park that we would play in. We would get on the subway and go to different destinations. And sort of my first time on the subway, we got all on the subway, which is quite a feat in and of itself, getting 15 8-year-olds through the turnstiles and to stand and wait on the platform and get into the same car. And then the car left and got to the first stop. The doors opened, the kids took off, and I was a little bit panicked, and there was sort of a sub-counselor, an older kid, maybe he was 13 or 14, from the area, and he said, "Don't worry." And what the kids were doing, they ran out of the car, and then they ran back into the car in back of it. So they were just giving me a little excitement. Mm-hmm. So, but that was, then we would go, there were city swimming pools, we would go to the pools. Mm-hmm. I became the swimming instructor for the entire camp and such like that.
During that summer, were you commuting back and forth from your family's home in Long Island? Or
no, I was sharing an apartment with my cousin, okay. One of those cousins who we shared the house with.
Oh, okay.
He had a small apartment on the west side of Manhattan.
Before we go on to graduate school, I know you have some notes there. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that we give you space to talk about if there's anything in undergraduate or growing up that you want to make sure we get on the record.
Yeah, you raised a question about the courses of particular interest, mm-hmm. et cetera. So in addition to John Mellor's and other courses then in economic development, I guess the courses I enjoyed the most were English literature and Greek literature courses, and my freshman English course and the teachers in all three of those.
So that's a bit of a difference from from your biology / ag economic.
Right.
Have you thought about or do you know why those courses appealed to you?
Well, the English Lit course was taught by Professor Healy, who was a wonderful teacher, and everyone said if you can take Healy's course, you should. And he made Shelley and Burns and Blake come alive. In the Greek literature, I'm not sure why I took that, but it was really very, very useful, interesting, I would say, and to see the themes in the Greek plays, they are played out in modern society and such. Mm-hmm. And the freshman English teacher, who was very good in about writing, we had a lot of writing requirements, and she was very good about making sure that you had your thoughts clearly laid out.
Anything else you want to talk about Cornell?
I met my wife.
Okay, always good to know.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that, meeting her, and then anything about the courtship you want to talk about?
I think it was sort of standard undergraduates. We started going out together, I guess, when I was a senior, and then we got married in 66, 3 years later.
So met in 63, married in 66?
Yeah.
Did she?
She was an English major, so maybe that had some impact on those courses.
Oh, okay. Did she follow you to Maryland, or were you?
No. Okay. I would commute. In those days, one could hitchhike. So often I would hitchhike up from Maryland to see her. She was, after college, she went to Catherine Gibbs Secretarial School to study to be a legal secretary. And she was staying in a hotel that was under contract with that school, the Barbizon Hotel for Ladies. And I would hitchhike up every now and again. Sometimes I would take the bus up to see her.
And I'm sorry, did you say that school was it in New York
in
City?
In Manhattan.
Okay, yeah. It was in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question that has nothing to do with oral history, your oral history, but it might, I guess. Being from New York, do you describe New York as the boroughs? Meaning, I just asked if you were it was in New York City, and you said it was in Manhattan. When you're talking about New York City, because I'm not from New York City,
right.
So to me it's New York City.
It varies.
Okay.
When people say, where are you born? Sometimes they'll say New York, but in fact, it was New York. It was Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And that's very different from someone who might have been born in Manhattan. Okay. Manhattan then was typically much higher income, and Brooklyn was where the immigrants settled.
I was just curious about that, mm-hmm. not being from there. Yeah. Could you describe your adjustment or your transition from undergraduate at Cornell to the early period at University of Maryland?
Well, I guess I found the courses easy. I did very well. This professor that Mellor recommended me to, his name was Phillips Foster, F-O-S-T-E-R. He was my major advisor and was good for that. And also, again, very good at brushing up my writing skills. He insisted on proper procedures for preparing research papers. And in fact, he later on, long after I was gone, wrote a book on the world food problem, which I've been using when I was teaching my course on world hunger. And indeed, it's the primary, best, most comprehensive text. Foster died a few years ago, and before that, a junior faculty member there started working with him, bringing out new editions every 3 to 5 years. So he was important for me. And I did the standard courses in economics and agricultural economics. When you do an ag economics major, essentially you're doing an economics major, and your specialty is agricultural economics. In my case, it was agricultural development. And there were some statistics courses, which I enjoyed a lot, did well in. I guess I did an anthropology course there, and I'll talk more about that when we get to Stanford.
Okay.
I don't have many memories of it except one research paper I did.
Okay. And as you were doing courses here, I guess, and this may apply to Cornell too, but because you mentioned that Mellor had an interest in India, are you starting to get an interest in not only agriculture and economics here in the U.S., but but the, around the world?
The interest was always in developing countries. Okay. Very little interest in the U.S. ag economics issues. You know, Miller's course was broad gauged, but after that I focused on development, and what interested me in his course was the discussions about India and about developing countries.
Okay. Was it developing for you? Was your interest developing countries writ large, or were there specific pockets within those developing countries that really interested you more?
At the start, it was writ large, and India was interesting because of Miller, but I later became much more interested in Africa. And I can trace that to the summer between my first and second years at Maryland, when I came back up to the city and took a summer school course at CCNY, City College of New York. And it was a course taught by a visitor who was an executive of, I can't recall the name, it's a big mining company that had interests in South Africa. And that sparked my interest in Africa.
Okay. At Maryland, were you required to do some type of thesis or some type of major paper?
Yeah. So my master's thesis was on a particular group or tribe in Zambia, and it's called the Shona, S-H-O-N-A. And what I wrote on was African socialism and the roots of African socialism in Fabian socialism with Beatrice and Sidney Webb as the leaders of that out of Britain. And that was sort of the socialist precursor to the African socialism that was picked up and run with by the likes of Leopold Senghor in Senegal and Julius Nyerere in Tanzania and Kenneth Kaunda in Zambia. And so what I did was to look at African socialism, Fabian socialism theories, and compare that with the tribal cultural procedures of the Shona tribe to, in a sense, test the argument that these African leaders were making, which was that traditional African society was essentially following Fabian socialist procedures. Okay. And it was all a library thesis. And that was, being in Maryland was good because I spent a lot of time that second year at the Library of Congress, and they have way up in the attic at the time, the human relations area files, I think they were called, which were not quite handwritten field notes, but sort of the next iteration from many, many anthropologists and graduate students who had tromped around in the bush. And so I was able to get a lot of information about the tribal society without actually going there.
You just mentioned the Library of Congress, so I get. Did you spend a lot of time in D.C. either at the Library of Congress or just sort of getting to know the capital city?
No, I spent a lot of time in the Library of Congress.
Okay. So that was
the bus that ran from College Park, Maryland, down to D.C., and I would be on that bus fairly frequently.
Was your thesis, was it a two-year program?
The master's program was essentially a year plus of courses and then the thesis. And I didn't finish writing it until the next year, by which time I'd come back up to Manhattan and spent that year in Manhattan and just polished it up. And I guess my degree would, I don't know when it would read, 65, 66, I'm not sure.
Okay.
So that, I don't know if you want to talk more
please,
about
please.
Maryland.
Yeah, that's fine.
I don't know if there's any more to say about Maryland.
Okay. The one thing I do want to ask, and it's a question that, I guess, for the most part, touches everyone who is of your age, who grew up in the 50s and 60s, or a young adult in the 50s and 60s, and that's the assassination of President Kennedy.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could talk about your memories of that.
I was in the Library of Congress when that happened, actually, and I had gone down to the basement where they had a snack bar, and this was also the time of, you know, shooting the rockets up to the moon and such like that, or into space before the moon. And I wandered by some little room in the basement, and there were a group of people gathered around the TV, and I asked someone who was at the back of the crowd if there was another rocket that was going up, and they were watching, and they told me that Kennedy had been shot and assassinated. And then soon thereafter, they announced that the library was closed. And I remember walking around D.C. That early evening, and it was a very strange atmosphere and feeling in the city.
So you took it. It sounds like, thank you for that anecdote. So it sounds like you took a year between master's and PhD.
Right. So by the time I was in my second year at Maryland, I knew that I wanted to do more work and focus on Africa and African economic development, and the best place to do that was Stanford, and I applied there. I had also applied to the University of Chicago, which saw fit not to accept me. Stanford was my first choice. And Stanford wrote back and said, okay, you seem to have done well. They didn't put it this way, but I could read between the lines. They said, you seem to have done very well at Maryland, so we'll accept you into the program, and we'll defer any funding for you until after your first semester. Well, they do a tri-semester out there.
Okay.
So I needed to have enough funding to pay my way that first trimester. So I came back up to Manhattan, and I got a small little apartment. Those days there was the rent-controlled apartment, so I had a studio apartment on 2nd Avenue between 11th and 12th Street for $85 a month, and that would probably have to add a zero or two in back of that to today. And I got a job working for the New York City Department of Welfare, which I credit as also an important experience. So my office base was all the way up in the Bronx near Yankee Stadium, and my field area was in South Bronx and in Harlem on the other side of the river. And that's where I got a good education about the lives of poor people in the city.
So in a way, did this build on that summer that you spent?
Yeah, very much so.
Okay. What sort of things would you do? Not that any day is typical, but when you're working for the Department of Welfare.
So a typical week would be 2 or 3 days in the field and 2 or 3 days back in the office. And in the field, you had a caseload probably of, I don't know, maybe 50 families. And you'd go through a rotation of visiting them every couple of months. And there were some things, so starting out new as a new caseworker, you had the opportunity when you take on a new case to bring everyone up to what was called standard. And that means, you know, did they have an apartment that was large enough for the family? Did they have enough coats and such and bedding and whatnot? And so the initial interviews with the family was just to find out about all that. And then if they were under the standard, then you could get extraordinary allocations for them to bring them up to standard. And the same was anytime you got a new case throughout the year, you had that opportunity. And I took great advantage of that to the point where, I don't know, about 6 months into the job, I was called on the carpet, not by my immediate supervisor, but by his supervisor. And she brought up the fact that I was spending an awful lot of money on my clients. And I said, well, that's what the regulations say. But she was trying to get me to tamp that down. Fortunately, my supervisor was not of the same mind, so I was able to continue that. But there was clearly a tension in the city welfare department on managing budgets. Mm-hmm. So I'd spend, as I say, about half the week walking around the streets and going into apartments and chatting with mostly the mothers, mostly single mothers, and their kids. And then back in the office writing up notes and checking out how to get them more money, such like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And was it at this point that you got married?
At the end of that year, okay. That summer.
So just before you left for Stanford.
Stanford, right.
What was your fiance then, wife, what was she doing in the
city? She was a legal secretary, first for a big name law firm, Strasser, Spiegelberg, Fried and Frank. And then she was recommended for the position to be the, did I say clerk? She was a legal secretary. And then to be the legal secretary to the head of the New York City Bar. So she was doing that.
From what you know, since she's your wife, was it difficult for her to leave New York to, and?
I don't think so. I think it was more difficult for her family. Her mother had passed away and her father actually remarried the week after we got married, which was fun. and in those days, going off to California might have been the ends of the earth.
Mm, right.
And, her father, one sign of that was her father, who was a physician, had her come to the clinic with one of his colleagues to get, I think it was a liver shot or something, to tide her over. We took our trip off to California.
How did you get across the country?
We drove. As I say, her father was a physician, and he gave us a lovely wedding present. I was planning to buy an old Nash Rambler. And in those days, Nash Ramblers had the reclining seats so you could sleep in the car. Mm-hmm. And that was how I was planning to drive across country. And dear old Dan Melvin bought us a Dodge Dart. And so we drove that across country. Drove through the South. His family, my father-in-law's family, was from Mississippi. And drove through there to visit some of the family that I had not met. And then across to New Orleans to other family in Houston, and then across to Southern California, across the desert in the middle of the day, I guess the Arizona desert, without air conditioning, which was an experience. We had a cold water thermos and kept dipping rags into it and mopping ourselves down and staying just this side of decent and how much clothes we had on, and mm-hmm. got to the checkpoint in Southern California. They check you for produce that you're not allowed to bring in. And we asked when it was going to cool off. And he asked us where we were going. And we were going straight up the Central Valley to Merced, to my wife's aunt. And he said, well, it's not going to cool off. It didn't. So this was in, I guess it would have been August. End of August, heading out to start schooling at Stanford.
That's when this is when somebody needs to make a joke about it being a dry heat, though, right?
That's right. It's not true that dry heat. I subsequently spent a lot of time in the in West Africa in the Sahel, up near the edges of the Sahara, and dry heat is hot.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. So I asked a question about the transition from, you know, undergraduate to graduate. You talk a little bit about the overview of the early transition to your PhD program at Stanford.
I guess the first thing was coming into that community of economists who were focused on Africa was really wonderful to have that community to talk with. At Stanford, it was interesting, the development economics was not in the economics department, so that my official, although my most of my work was in the economics department, the development work was in a unit that was called the Food Research Institute, same name as we have here. But that name goes back to history when they started after World War II looking at the world food situation. But it had evolved by the 60s into a focus on economic development. And so the economics department sort of seeded all the development economics work to the Food Research Institute. And they were in the same building and a lot of joint departments. So it was the group of especially two faculty members, Bill Jones and Bruce Johnston, who had the most African experience and were leaders in the field. So that was very positive to be in that group. And then, as most graduate students, you in economics, you start through a series of basic or advanced economic theory courses and econometrics courses, and then you do your field courses, and mine were in development economics. So, and it was there that I also enjoyed the econometrics, the sort of statistical applications to economics. And actually, when I started there, I wasn't sure I wanted to go on for a PhD, but after taking that course, I decided I definitely did, because it was clear to me then that you could use your economic theory and your statistical tools to get at understanding human behavior in the economic sphere. And that's really where my interests were, as opposed to a lot of people who are interested in how does the economy work. I was interested in how do people operate as economic actors.
You mentioned that you took an anthro class. This where, do you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I'm not sure. Well, I guess because of my interest in Africa, I wound up taking an undergraduate course in anthropology by Professor Gibbs, G-I-B-B-S, and Gibbs, I can't recall his first name. His expertise was in Liberia, so a lot of the course was about Africa, and I enjoyed that a lot. And then subsequently, I took a course in economic anthropology by Professor Cancian, C-A-N-C-I-A-N, and enjoyed that a lot, where I could see the economics and the anthropology coming together. And through those courses and otherwise, I developed a cadre of friends who were anthropology students. So that, and that reflects my interest in the economics being the economics of individual choice and how people operate as economic actors.
Now, looking at it that the way you were choosing to look at it, was that different at the time than other people were choosing to look at developmental economics?
There was sort of the macro approach, big planning models, linear programming. You know, I did some of that programming work as a student. The Soviet Union at that time was riding high, and we studied their planning models. So there was clearly that. And then there was a strain of economics that, in a sense, meshed the two, sort of what they call the two-sector models, where the theory was you had the manufacturing sector and you had the agriculture sector, and agriculture had all this so-called surplus labor, or at least cheap labor, that could be moved into the manufacturing sector so that the manufacturing sector in developing countries could be a low-wage sector, so there could be profits that would allow the economy to reinvest and move ahead. And then there was those who were looking at individual behavior. And maybe there weren't too many in that camp. Bill Jones wrote an influential article called the Rationality of the African Peasant. And then there was a book by T.W. Schultz. What was the name of the book? I don't know. But out of that book came the notion of the poor but efficient peasant. So there was that group that was looking at, you know, how do our notions of economic rationality apply to peasant farmers in Africa or other places. And T.W. Schultz won the Nobel Prize, and he is an alum of my department here, Ag and Applied Economics. was a professor at Chicago. So, and it was, I guess, largely Bill Jones's influence that spurred me to continue to look at the individual within the economic development work.
So would Jones then be considered would you consider him a mentor of yours?
Yeah, very much, both Jones and Johnston. Then the third one was Peter Timmer, who came on actually as a young faculty member, a new hire, and ultimately went back to Harvard, where he had done his degree, and became the Black professor of economics.
Did you say Timmer?
Yeah, T-I-M-M-E-R. And Timmer had done some breakthrough work on using linear programming to get to optimization functions, and I was able to use that and tweak it a little bit in my thesis, as one part of my thesis.
How soon into the program at Stanford did you find or choose or discover what your thesis or dissertation was going to be?
Probably by the second year, I knew that I wanted to go into the field and work on these questions of understanding the economic activity of individuals in poor countries, and particularly in Africa. And there had been other people at Stanford who had done similar. I think it was probably in that second year that an anthropologist and an agronomist came to be visiting professors in the institute, and they had come back from doing work in a particular part of Tanzania, where I ultimately wound up doing my thesis work.
Okay.
And so talking with them was influential.
So you said your master's thesis was library-based, meaning, you know, no going to Africa.
Right.
Did you travel to Africa for your dissertation?
Right.
Okay.
So I spent 17 months in Tanzania, and most of that was what we call upcountry, in just south of Lake Victoria. And my research area ran from the south shore of Lake Victoria down maybe 15 miles. It was a case study work. And I wanted to say something about financing of the thesis at that time. At that time, if you wanted to do field work, it was understood that you would get your own funds. And I think that's different now, where students will typically become part of a research project run by their advisor or someone in the department, and that advisor will have funding to send the student. When I was there, or at least the case was in Stanford, you're expected to get your own funds. So I was able to apply for and get a Social Science Research Council grant, which was called, I think, the Foreign Area Fellowship at that time, which was quite generous. It provided for travel to Tanzania for me and my wife, and for maintenance for the two of us for 17 months. And it even had enough stipend in it for me to buy a small Land Rover. Didn't have the full cost of that. I had to sell it back in order to stay even and to hire a team of enumerators. And I also applied for and got a National Science Foundation dissertation grant to go alongside of that. So that it was very much my own project and my own financing, which is different, I think, from the current situation where most thesis research now is a part of a faculty member's ongoing research program. So I had to convince my advisors that this was a good project and that they needed to generate enough interest so that they would advise me and read and such like that. And the circumstances were that we were out in the countryside. There was a small missionary hospital not too far from us. And other than that, we were the only non-Africans for many, many miles in the whole district. And to get to the research site, we took a train from Dar es Salaam up to the city of Mwanza, M-W-A-N-Z-A, on the shore of Lake Victoria, and then had to drive and then get on a ferry and go across a part of the lake to get to what was then called Geita District, G-E-I-T-A. And through connections from the University of Dar es Salaam, in order to do the research, I had to have an affiliation at the University of Dar es Salaam. And so my advisor at the university there was able to connect me with the Ministry of Agriculture in this area. And they were able to arrange for us to get a small little concrete bungalow on a sub-district research station, which consisted of two bungalows and an office. And so we had a little three-room house with no electricity, no telephone, no water. And we were able to jimmy-rig up in the backyard some water. And we lived there for a little over a year, and then it was like a month and a half before that in Dar es Salaam, and about a month after that. So for maybe 14 months living out in that little place. And at that time, it was considered legitimate to do very intensive case studies, and that's what I did. So I had a sample of 75 households, and I hired five enumerators, and I had them visiting the 75 families three times a week for interviews that lasted about an hour at each family, taking detailed information on all the inputs and outputs, including labor, on their farming operations, on each of the fields that they were farming on. And this was an area where it was a mixed farming between the crops were corn, or maize, cassava, cotton for cash, and then about a third of the families had cattle. And most of them had some small stock as well.
These enumerators, were they locals?
Yeah, so these were high school graduates. So when I first got out to the area, I went around to some of the local high schools and asked for recommendations of their recent graduates, and then tracked them down and interviewed a bunch and hired these five young men. And four of them actually did all the interviewing, and the fifth one was my personal assistant. I should say that before going out, I learned Swahili as well as Sukuma, Kisukuma, S-U-K-U-M-A, which was the tribal language of the area. And that probably helped me get that SSRC grant. I recall being interviewed for the grant, and one of the interviewers said, "Well, how can we say no? He speaks Swahili and econometrics." But I talk a bit about that research experience because it's very different from what graduate students in development do now. It's I don't know of anyone who's gone and spent a year and a half in the field collecting firsthand data on such an intensive basis. So now research on farmer behavior is based on very large samples that are visited maybe two or four times in the year. It's a very different approach. And then the other approach, which is sort of coming back around, is experimental economics, in which people are trying to understand how individuals make decisions based on having them go through a series of experiments. Well, let's say, you know, if the price of such and such is this and that, and then if the price changes, how would you, sort of hypothetical experiments. So experimental economics is now a very big deal to get at questions of how are people making economic decisions. Back then, the way I went at it was to go out and actually talk to the people. So I had my enumerators doing those data collection, and then I would visit. I spent all my time out in the farms, measuring farmers' fields and having structured interviews with the farmers to ask them about some of their decisions, also to gather data about what was then called modernization, and seeing how there might or might not be linkages with modernization, education, immigration, literacy, and their decisions about how they allocated their resources and what technologies they used with the resources they had allocated. So something called allocative efficiency and technical efficiency in economics.
So if your in-laws thought California was,
oh God,
a world away.
Well, my father-in-law's words to my wife as we were getting on the plane was, "You'll come back in a box." So I'm sure it was half in jest, but it was certainly an element of concern, shall we say, about going off. You know, and neither of us had been out of the country except, I guess I'd been to Canada, and I guess my wife had been to the St. Lawrence River in Canada. That was going off as we did to the heart of Africa, way off in the boondocks. There was not even any email.
Right.
This is really pre-computer. Mm-hmm. Computers were just starting to come along.
But maybe a couple of things about that, and I think we might end it here.
Okay.
And then start the next time about finishing the dissertation and getting. So what was that time? What was the 17 months? What was that time period?
That was September of 69 through March of 71, would it have been? Mm-hmm. That count, right?
No? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, something like that.
So you, in some way, you were gone during, well, you were gone during a chunk of sort of the student protest, Vietnam stuff.
Right, yeah. So I missed a big chunk of American history. And that was also the time when the environmental movement got
right.
started.
So maybe we might come back to that in the follow-up interview.
Okay.
A little bit about that. The other thing I want to ask, I alluded to it and not tongue-in-cheek about how your father-in-law felt about Africa, so I want to talk a little bit about how you and your wife adjusted or possibly didn't adjust to you know, life in Africa, particularly the 14 months with limited comforts of home.
Yes. You know, the comforts of home, you adjust and you figure out how to get things done. The biggest positive was the hospitality of the farm families and researchers. Many, many researchers will tell you the same thing. These are very poor people, and the hospitality is just overwhelming. They take you into the home, and there's always the best food and eagerness to have you stay and have a meal. And which we did very, very often. And we would have the farmers come to our little house. I recall the first invitation we had, they said, come on Saturday and we'll have lunch. And I said, well, when should we be there? And they said, what do you mean when? You'll come when you'll come. You think I'm going to turn you away if you come? Anyway, that was the attitude. And they were such nice people. That was just a wonderful experience. In terms of comforts of home, the place that we moved into had been sort of a way station for travelers and was beat up and dirty. So when we came up country, we stayed a month in that city of Mwanza while I was finding enumerators and making protocol visits to local officials, and at the same time cleaning out that house and then painting every surface, including the floor of the house. It was, as I said, a concrete place. There was two bedrooms, one that was an office and one was our bedroom, and then there was a big room across the front, and we dedicated part of it as our living room, so-called, and part of it as a kitchen. So how do you have a kitchen when they don't have electricity or gas? So you have a kerosene refrigerator. It has a tub of kerosene that you keep filling at the bottom, and it has a wick and that you keep burning, and somehow, I'm not a physicist, but burning that, it keeps the refrigerator cool and even allows you to have a little freezer in the refrigerator. And the problem is that you have to keep the wick trimmed. If you don't, then it starts to spew off soot. And more than one morning, we would wake up and find everything covered with black soot. Mm. And we'd have to start the whole cleaning operation again. And then there was a stove. And we were able to get cans of, I guess, propane or something for the stove. And we would drive into Mwanza. It was about, an hour and a half to 2 hours, depending on whether or not you missed the ferry. It would take about a half an hour to get over this bay of Lake Victoria that was between us and the town. We'd drive for a half hour, get on the ferry for a half hour, and then drive for another half hour to the city. If we missed the ferry, then add another hour. Of course, the ferry would go out and back. Mm-hmm. We would go in every 2 weeks or so to buy food. By the time we get it home, or even when we bought it, there was a good surface of green on these long fillets of beef that we would get, and my wife would hack off the green stuff and throw that out the door for the dogs or whoever would come, and she would chop up the rest and freeze it or boil it up so that we'd have it. When we first got there, someone gave us a chicken, and it was, this was by that time, I guess, November, and we were told, you know, just keep the chicken, keep it fat, and then you can have it for Christmas dinner. By that time, my wife had gotten so attached to the chicken that we had hired what was called a houseman to help out, and we did have Anton, the houseman, dispatch the chicken, but my wife didn't want to have any more live chickens for our meals. So we had a lot of beef at that time. We managed to rig up in the backyard of this place a water supply, and so that allowed us to take a shower out back, have actually a flush toilet, and my wife and Anton were able to do the laundry out back. And for lights, we had kerosene lights and such like that. So,
so I'm going to wrap this up for today, but okay. I always want to leave you with the last word. Is there anything on those notes that you have there or your time in Africa that you want to make sure we get on the record in case it doesn't come to mind next time?
Well, I should say that all that data collection generated large sheets of data, which we wanted entered into the computer. And we didn't, of course, have a computer up there. And in fact, in the country, in Tanzania, they were just starting to computerize their government operations, and the Ministry of Finance had bought a big computer and was just testing it out. And they were happy to take my data sheets and enter them and punch them up as computer cards, so we would mail data sheets into the capital every week, and they would punch them up And that was, I guess, an act of faith that the mail would get through and such like that. And that generated about 150,000 computer cards. And then there are stories about trying to get those back to Stanford.
Right. And let's...
we can talk about
that. Yeah, why don't we maybe start with that next time. Okay. So, Ken, I want to thank you for your time today.
Appreciate it. You're welcome.